This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Clipping, Copying, and Thinking, a panel discussion held to celebrate the republication of A Little Commonplace Book. The discussion featured historian Anne Blair and poet Kenneth Goldsmith, and it was moderated by Cabinet editor D. Graham Burnett. It took place on March 18th, 2011.
So again, we'll get to this over the course of the conversation this evening, but the term commonplace, which comes down to us as meaning something hackneyed, something kind of not very interesting that we've all heard before, had a very distinctive meaning in the Renaissance, early modern period, and into the Enlightenment. It didn't mean that thing we've all heard 1,000 times before. It referred specifically to the practice of keeping your reading notes, of culling. I'm being told that I should use the mic, so be brave. It referred to the practice of maintaining your commonplaces, meaning collating your reading, aggregating your reading notes, and assembling your favorite passages, generally from classical authors, under significant headings. And those headings could be useful to you if you needed to give a speech later on, say, virtue. Thank you. On virtue, you could look up any particular virtue or, say, fault of virtue, and find there under concupiscence, say, a host of bits from Horace or whatever referring to that subject, and assemble them for your talking. On that subject, we have with us this evening basically the universe's leading scholar. And so I'll segue from an introduction to the book and the launch of the book to an introduction to our panelist, who'll be speaking first in just a moment, Anne Blair. Anne Blair is a professor of history at Harvard. She is a MacArthur Fellow, first book on Jean Bodin, and most recent book, which was just written up very nicely in Gopnik's piece in The New Yorker, Too Much to Know, Managing Scholarly Information Before the Modern Age. And Anne's research over the last 8 years, let's say, has really done more than anything anyone has done to draw our attention to the ways that our contemporary sense of an information explosion was mirrored in the late Renaissance and the early modern period. So we think of the information explosion as characteristic of our moment and our times, but Anne has, in remarkable ways, sensitized us to the extent to which Renaissance thinkers facing the explosion of printed texts after the development of the printing press were themselves aswim in new cosmoses of text that seemed overwhelming and impossible to manage vis-a-vis the manuscript culture that preceded it. So Anne will be talking with us a little bit tonight about early modern and Renaissance techniques of textual appropriation and practices of information management. And we couldn't have a better mashup, a kind of folding in time between the Renaissance and our own moment, I don't think, because we also have with us someone who will be known to many of you, Kenny Goldsmith, who, and the title of his immediately forthcoming book is a perfect analog to Anne's Too Much to Know. Kenny's later this year has a book coming out called Uncreative Writing, Managing Language in the Digital Age. So Uncreative Writing, Managing Language in the Digital Age, Too Much to Know, Managing Scholarly Information Before the Modern Age. And that should set up our thematics for this evening. Textual appropriation, information management as a scholarly practice, as a creative practice, early modern period, right now, and looking forward. Parallels, differences. We hope to find our way there over the course of the conversation. So what we thought we would do is go ahead and let each of our speakers talk a little bit about what they've done in their books. So we'll start with Anne, who will talk with us a little bit about The Project of Too Much to Know, textual appropriation in the Renaissance. And then Kenny will pick up with his current work, and then we'll get a conversation going. Program will last for about an hour, we think, and before we're finished, we'll go to the audience for questions. Anne, talk to us.
Great. How's this? Just me. Great. Well, thanks so much. This is really fun. I am a scholar of a rather dank and dusty period, and to see it resonate with current concerns is really very exciting. So I specialize in Renaissance humanism, basically. These are the people like Erasmus, Montaigne, and so on, who were very keen on restoring ancient literature and the mastery of the classics. And one of the things they restored was ancient rhetoric, described by Quintilian, for example, who also describes the method of loci. Rhetoric is based on collecting stuff, arguments, according to certain categories. And there would be 10 of them, typically, in Quintilian rhetoric. This is the word for place. There are many kinds of loci. Not all of them are common. There could be theological places also. That's a loci theologici is a common title for books by reformers, for example, who basically are using headings, the places, to collect good stuff that you should know about as a reader. So the practice starts, I think, with the schoolboy and the Renaissance pedagogue, these humanists, which, you know, who started humanism, after all, by teaching kids, boys, to master the ancient texts, and in order to do so, to copy out the best bits, the good stuff, in notebooks in two ways. In the order in which they read the text, so all your Cicero, all your Horace, and then often copying again from one notebook into another notebook under sorted headings. All the stuff on virtue, all the stuff on vice, all the stuff on, and you can go on to much less judgmental categories if you'd like. I don't want to say that this is a completely new practice with the Renaissance, because in fact, during the Middle Ages, there were sermon compt books, which were florilegia. The word means collections of flowers, and these are designed to be collections of the best bits of the Bible and the church fathers, typically, that you want to have ready to hand whenever you need to produce a sermon. So in fact, the Renaissance is, on the one hand, inheriting from the Middle Ages a practice they don't really acknowledge as very similar, and looking back to antiquity, like Quintilian, as the source for something they are reviving. And I think, in other words, what we're seeing here is a long continuity of a practice of textual management. And I call them the four S's. You select the good stuff, you summarize it sometimes, if it's too long, or and then you sort it under the headings, and of course you store it, you save it in notebooks, and then ultimately in printed reference books, where you make available to people who don't have the time or energy or access to books to do it themselves, to bring them the best bits, already sorted, already collected. So my book is the corpus of sources. It looks back to antiquity in the Middle Ages, but it focuses on early Latin printed reference books from 1500 to 1700. Nothing less creative, really, as a kind of genre. It is designed, these are books that are designed to recycle the best bits. Best bits basically come in two kinds. One are rhetorical turns of phrase, things that you'll want to use yourself when writing a letter to mom and dad asking for more money when you're a student, or when writing a dedication or an oration to a patron to try and attract attention to your own projects. So rhetorical expressions that are worth repeating and reusing and perhaps playing with. And secondly, what I would call examples. Historical anecdotes, morality tales taken from nature, stuff, matter, sort of historical or natural historical facts, to use a term that, of course, really is only born a little later in the early 17th century. And these would be another kind of commonplace, would be anecdotes about the past or observations about nature. So that's sort of the practice, then, of copying. I alluded to the schoolboy method, where you copy it out. Often you copy it again. One of the purposes of that, of course, is to master it, is to bring it into memory so that you're not just relying on your notes. You're going to know the stuff. You'll be able to pull it out without prompting, readily. So that's the, and that's of course something that one hopes that everyone will carry on as they grow older, as they become adults. They will continue to take notes. And in fact, from the Renaissance on, we have amazingly large collections of notes. For example, you know, 20 volumes of manuscript notes by this guy William Drake, studied by Kevin Sharp, who's a gentleman from the Civil War period. Some of these are in his hand, some of them are in the hand of an amanuensis. So often this is teamwork. Or even for Poliziano, we have multiple volumes of manuscript notes. So that's much earlier, 15th century Italy. Interestingly, we don't have large collections of reading notes before then. There are survival reasons for that. For example, we know, or at least we have on good authority from Pliny's nephew, Pliny the Elder, left to him, bequeathed to him, 160 rolls of parchment with a commentarii, he calls them, notes, sorted notes, taken in a small hand on both sides. So lots of stuff there. But this is a parchment roll from the first century of the Common Era. It's not going to last that long unless some Christian monk comes along and decides it's worth copying onto parchment. Pliny's notes? I don't think so. Pliny's natural history, thankfully, yes. And presumably, these are the notes from which the 38 books of the natural history, which is the largest single reference book from antiquity that has come down to us complete, presumably that's where they came from. But then from the Middle Ages, we have someone like Thomas Aquinas, about whom we know a lot about how he worked. We have some autographed manuscripts of his, but we don't have reading notes. And I think we can argue from absence that if he had taken reading notes, we would have some of them, sort of treated like relics the way some of his other handwritten autographed manuscripts are. And by the way, he had a horrible handwriting known as the scriptura inintelligibilis. So take solace that there's a good precedent here for messy note-taking and messy handwriting. But he probably didn't take notes. He rather composed by dictation. So his secretaries described how he would wake them up in the night. He could dictate to three or four people simultaneously, which is taken to be miraculous, although it is also said of Winston Churchill, interestingly. So we have someone there who's producing lots of text, no doubt about that, but without an abundant stock of notes. So what I'm arguing is new about the Renaissance is this idea of stockpiling the notes in their note form. And some people who take lots of notes don't actually publish anything from them. Some of them are recycling the material from their notes in letters that they exchange with their correspondents. Some of them just sit on their notes. Of course, some people do publish from their notes. But note-taking in itself has become something you do as an educated person to keep up with your reading, to manage it, to be able to imitate better, to better master proper ancient stuff, cultural baggage, or rhetorical turns of phrase. So how do these things get used? As in the Middle Ages, one of the uses of reference books and notes are for sermon writing. And in fact, Benjamin Franklin talks about his, if he had decided to become a preacher, his uncle would have set him up with his notes as a stock to set up from. But though he would have had to learn his hand. So clearly the handwriting was a bit of an issue even then. So sermons, certainly. Orations, we've mentioned, letters. And someone like Montaigne clearly is operating from not perhaps a large set of notes that he compiled, but commonplace reading. What we have is annotated books in his possession where we can see headings that he introduces into the margin next to an example in print that he likes. And sometimes the heading is corrected. It's changed. He's gone over it and decided he wants to use it a different way from what he'd expected to. So here's a literary figure whom we can document cutting and pasting in a mental way from books in his library. He's got probably about 1,000 books in his library in his Bordeaux castle, which can be visited today. And he is, of course, defending himself. He says, you know, far from me to do those patchwork of commonplaces. And yet, of course, his work is full of allusions, tacit allusions to all those classic authors, woven in with his own observations, his own experiences, historical examples that he's sometimes getting from reference books, and that's been pretty much documented. Of course, he's doing it all tacitly. In a modern edition of Montaigne, you'll get everything, you know, all the quotations will be italicized and a source will be attributed. In the original, it's all one typeface and no mention of any ancient author. and frankly, even no paragraphing. So you can imagine the Apologie de Raymond Sebon is 120 pages in print now. It is one long paragraph. And so it's just a flow in which, of course, he is using and playing and going far beyond his sources. And yet, it is a kind of creativity that's heavily beholden to lots of different sources, a wide range of reading. I think I might stop there.
Terrific. There's lots more back to, but let's fast forward from
archives. Bah. They're overrated. They're overrated. Nobody will listen to the archives. So anyway, what I want to say is it seems appropriate to this new condition that we're facing in writing today, faced with an unprecedented amount of available text. The problem is not needing to write any more of it. Instead, we have to learn to negotiate the vast quantity of it that it currently exists. So how, as a writer, I make my way through this thicket of information, how I manage it, how I parse it, how I organize it, how I archive it, how I distribute it, is what is going to, or what does, distinguish my writing from yours, okay? And so the literary critic Marjorie Perloff has recently begun using the term unoriginal genius to describe this emergency, this emergent tendency, this emergent, there's a good slip too. It is a tendency emerging in literature. Her idea is that because of changes brought on by technology and the internet, our notion of genius, a romantic, isolated figure, is outdated. An updated notion would have to center around one's mastery of information and its dissemination. And she's coined this term, moving information, to signify both the act of pushing language around as well as the act of being emotionally moved by that process. And she, Perloff, says that today's writer resembles more programmer than a tortured genius, brilliantly conceptualizing, constructing, executing, and actually maintaining a writing machine. And I can say that this idea of unoriginal genius, as Anne has just said, I mean, it's not a theoretical conceit. It's a realized writing practice, and I think very differently from what you're talking about as it is today. But you can take this back to the early part of the 20th century, really, where construction or conception of a text is as important as what the text says or does. And I think we have to think, for example, of the collated note-taking practice of Walter Benjamin's Arcades projects, or the mathematically constraint-based works by the Ulipo. And of course, technology today has exacerbated these machinistic tendencies in writing crazy. I mean, there are several web-based versions of Raymond Queneau's 1961, laboriously hand-carved 100,000 billion poems on the web today, where he actually sliced up a book, and then each time you turn one of those slices, it's a brand new poem. Now, of course, this is all over. So as a result, writers are exploring ways of writing that have been thought traditionally to be outside of the scope of literary practice, really recently, but obviously not so we have writers using employing word processing as a writing technique. I am a word processor. Databasing, recycling, appropriation, plagiarism, intentional plagiarism, identity ciphering, and intensive programming, to name a few. Just kind of a couple of more things. Over the past 5 years, we've seen works such as a retyping of Jack Kerouac's On the Road in its entirety, a page a day every day on a blog for a year. And you were talking about people, a way of pirating books on Amazon has actually been to retype or repaste sections of book into reviews. And this was an early way of pirating books in their entirety. As a matter of fact, recently the entire edition of Ulysses has been translated into QR codes, right? And so when you load up the page, it's hundreds of thousands of QR codes that can be read sequentially to be translated and distributed in that way. My own book, Day, is a day's copy of the New York Times, which I retyped, which was published as a 900-page book. Writers are publishing list poems that are nothing more than reframing of listings of stores from shopping mall directories into poetic forms. And Craig Dworkin's great book called Parse, which is a... He took Edward Abbott's 19th century grammar book on how to parse, and he parsed the book according to its own methods, even down to its own index. So I mean, all it is noun, verb, adjective, cardinal, number, ordinal. I mean, it's all the way down to the index. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. There's also a lawyer, Vanessa Place, who represents legal briefs from her day job as poetry. She doesn't do anything different. What she does is she represents indigent sex criminals during the day. She represents them. And she takes those documents that are in the public domain and she simply republishes them as poetry in their entirety without changing a word or the form at all. Okay? Caroline Bergvall, for example, spent a long time in the British Library copying down the first verse of every translation of Dante's Inferno, every English translation that the library has, one after another, page after page, until she's exhausted the supplies. What you see is the very first verse and the different interpretations of that. She doesn't do anything. She just moves language from one place to another. These writers are language hoarders. Their projects are epic, mirroring the gargantuan scale of textuality on the web. It's not a nihilistic, begrudging type of a thing, or even outright rejection, in fact, or it's not presumed technological enslavement. In fact, writing is celebratory, right? It's joyful. There's unanticipated beauty, some elements of it that are grammatical, other structural. Mostly, though, they're philosophical. And I often say that these books are awful to read, but they're great to think about. I mean, I say my books are absolutely unreadable. I've never read them. They bore me to tears. But they're wonderful to think about. So I often say I have a readership. I have a thinkership rather than a readership. And there's emotion. There's emotion. Actually what we find in moving information is that it's really hard to rid language of its emotional content. That language as material, and I want to talk about materiality with language, is inherently emotional. It's very, we've seen modernism try to eradicate emotion from it. Even somebody like Jackson McClough, who works with chance operations, in fact, those are very richly subjective and emotional texts. He couldn't succeed in doing it. And so I'll just end up with a quote from Craig Dworkin, who posits possibilities for new writing. The kind of idea becomes a machine that makes the art, something very familiar to those of you with Saul Alinsky. Dworkin says, what would a non-expressive poetry look like, a poetry of intellect rather than of emotion, one in which the substitutions at the heart of metaphor and image were replaced by the direct presentation of language itself, with spontaneous overflow supplanted by meticulous procedure and exhaustively logical process, in which the self-regard of the poet's ego would turn back onto the self-reflexive language of the poem itself, so that the test of poetry were no longer whether could it what were no longer whether it could have been done better, which is the question of the workshop, but whether it could have conceivably been done otherwise.
Okay, so the place where Kenny has left us takes me right to the first thing I'd like us to go in on. Pache, both the modernist moves and subsequently the postmodernist moves, that sought to break the tradition of kind of allegorical linkage between textual practices and selfhood, right? Pace all that. It's very hard to escape from a sense that our textual practices are intimately bound up with our practices of selfhood. So I hear this, but I guess the first place I'd like us to go is toward relating these collatory tactics of textual citation, appropriation, rearrangement. I'd like us to think a little bit by contextualizing that in the emergent conceptions of the self in the early modern period, and then come back around here and maybe channel, I don't know, I love Charlie Williams. Maybe we channel C.K. Williams for a moment and think about, you know, what, no.
We're not going to channel C.K. Williams. I won't permit that.
I have a great Charlie Williams, and I have Kenny Goldsmith anecdote, which I can tell. And
yes.
Kenny wins, so it's a safe one to offer.
God, no, yeah, this is really.
It's a great.
This is why I'm.
We'll get there. But there are hard questions to ask. There are hard questions to ask. The modernist moment that first enjoyed the kind of aphasic fragmentation of language as an expressive medium was itself explicitly preoccupied with notions of shattering of traditional notions of the self, and they took that to be a crisis of their time. So we aren't superimposing a notion of crisis when we relate these notions of textual fragmentation to transformed and possibly even conceivably pathological conceptions of the self in the interwar period or something. So we need to think about what we're doing that's different from that. I know it hurts, but anyway.
No, it's very easy.
You got a minute. All right, you got
Sina,
a minute,
can I,
though.
Can I have some more water, please? Thank
you. Water for Kenny. Would you?
Water, please, yes.
And would you talk to us a little bit about how these practices were part of ways of thinking about the management of self and the formation and composition of a self in the early modern period?
Absolutely, that's a great question. Obviously, the Renaissance is one of those periods which is traditionally viewed as having a greater awareness of the self than the Middle Ages. So many of those florilegia I was describing from the Middle Ages are anonymous. Or occasionally they're named, therefore, after the location of the manuscript today. So there's the florilegium duacense of Douay, because the manuscript is from Douay. And so these were made presumably in monastic settings to aid the brothers. And of course, once they're made, they can be added to, and we don't know exactly who first compiled them and then who added to them. They do actually often then solidify at some point, and we get more florilegia. Although that's of course true of the print genres as well, but the print ones do tend to have an author on the title page. So there's a first person. And there's this one guy, Domenico Nanni Mirabelli, who's of course not known today, but he became a brand name of a florilegium for 200 years. Of course, you know, he was only alive for two editions of his thing. And after that, it's many other editors who added to it. Some of them become canonized. By the mid-17th century, there are six names on the title page as the people through whose hands this work went. Of course, many other people contributed to the work who aren't on that list of six, either people who were helpers to those six or also intermediate editors. So it's a very, and this is a genre that grows very easily. You can always stuff more in. So in a way, there's an anonymity to it still, which is present in some cases. On the other hand, I would like to pick up on a couple of Kenny's points. The idea of celebrating hoarding is very much part of the self-representation and self-image of at least one of these compilers, who had a very personal scheme, not alphabetized. He presented his 4.5 million theater of human life in a systematic order that he rearranged at great cost to himself, great complication, three times over. And he had made a self-portrait of himself featuring the fall of Bellerophon, one of these Icarus figures, sort of Look how high I went, you know. And it's, all this hubris is in his self-portrait. And, of course, in front of him are the memento mori, the hourglass, and the skull. So this sort of, you know, I have flirted with immortality, and yet I'm aware that I will die, I think is his message. So there's a very personal book. It's all about hoarding more than anyone has before and better sorted than anybody has done before. And, of course, his legacy was another sequel that goes to 10 million words, doubles the size of it, by a guy whose name we have, Laurentius Bayerlinck, who actually, though a Catholic, describes, he doesn't name them because they're Protestants, but he describes the lineage of this work through, actually, Zwinger's stepfather had given him a store of notes. Zwinger acknowledges this. Zwinger himself, Zwinger's son, who adds a good index, the printer who commissioned the sequel, and then the man who does the sequel himself. So there's this sort of laying on of hands in the art of hoarding. And I think it is very much a celebration of what we can do, just how much. I mean, Zwinger talks about how he has presented here all of human behavior, just as God will see them at the last judgment. Circa 1600, that takes guts to sort of put that in your preface.
And can you say just a word about the way in which many of these practices reflect a desire to kind of cull from classical antiquity the sort of basic moral and ethical principles of successful political or civil life? So again, these practices of self-making through your reading in the classics.
Absolutely. So that's how you become a member of this club, of the educated, is by being able to look back to ancient history for models of how to behave now when you face crises and decisions. Montaigne, for example, one of his early essays is when to parley at a siege. So you go through, okay, these guys were besieged and they parleyed with the enemy and this stuff happened to them and these guys didn't and this stuff happened to them and so now it's your turn. You know, you're besieged and you've got to decide to parley or not. Sadly, the message isn't always so obvious because, of course, you've got examples on both sides that it was a good thing or a bad thing to do. But that is the reason to steep yourself in this store of human experience.
So part of what's so strange is that, in a sense, very similar technologies, cutting and clipping and pasting together, are in one case, not to oversimplify, but they are kind of part of a notion of a self-making. And I think, can you correct me if you think I'm wrong, it's striking that many of the same textual practices, cutting, clipping, in effect are used metonymically at the beginning of the modernist period to reflect something like a shattering of what are understood to be 19th century notions of the self.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely. But what we're dealing with now is, you know, that's quaint compared to the large scale uncreative writing that's going on today you know, cutting and pasting always implied an exquisite sense of going into a text and removing, I love this, you keep coming back to the best bits.
Yeah.
And that was really predicated on a certain skill. Right. Going in and man, I'm going to mine the best bits, you know, data mining the best bits. You know, the best bits are not interesting. And bits were the stuff that modernism was made of, the shattering of the atomizing of language. This is something different. This is actually picking the entire thing up and moving it over here without having altered it or picking out the best, you know, the best bits from it. I mean, it really is a literal lifting that has its roots, you know, that has its permissions. I don't want to say its roots, but has its permissions in Duchamp, you know. And you have to think that in all of modernism, textual appropriation on a full scale has never happened, has never occurred. Absolutely amazing. 100 years after Duchamp, you still do not have an occasion of somebody actually lifting other people's texts entirely and naming it their own, or in the case of Vanessa Place, where it gets more complicated, that she actually wrote those texts and then she appropriates her own text, but of course they didn't have her name on it. And of course, you know, I mean, the practice gets very, very complicated. So what we're talking about here is actually something brand new that happens as a result of the digital age. Now, I'm not talking about e-poetry. I'm not talking about net art, this kind of thing. I'm actually talking about page-bound practice and how information management has affected page-based practice today. Okay? And it has. It's really changed writing, right? It doesn't even, you know, you open up page 50, it may not even look that different than a book from 50 years ago or 100 years ago. You know, but in fact, the whole mentality behind it, and the reason for this is, and the reason that I have to think that this never happened in all of modern, people say, oh, Kathy Acker. Kathy Acker took a few pages. Kathy Acker didn't take all of Dickens. Kathy Acker went in and got the best bits out of Dickens. You know, and she, you know, great, great stuff. Was the fact that prior to the fluidity of digital language, the amount of work to retype something was enormous. You know, I mean, it was absolutely a physical labor. As opposed to today, well, I can go to Gutenberg and I can get everything that Shakespeare wrote in one file, and with one simple click, I highlight it all and I copy the entire oeuvre of Shakespeare, the entire thing, and I hold it in my clipboard. You see, this is very, very powerful. This is extremely powerful. So you, in the 20th century, you had a lot of cutting and pasting. So the scissor was the operative, and you know, the nomenclature, of course, carries over cutting and pasting, which doesn't really make, you know, which is not, I don't think, that accurate, in fact, because it implies that you had burrows. You know, you had burrows that were taking, cutting up texts and putting them back together with a pot of glue and scissors. So it was a very, you know, it's a very different type of thing. I don't want to, you know, modernism certainly led to it, but technology enables a complete other scale of information management movement.
So I was going to try to hold off on this, but again, I think Kenny's brought it right into the middle of the room, so I think we have to look right at it, the kind of implicit technological determinism that looms over this style of argument. And you already cited it with Perloff saying that, you know, there have been these transformations in technology and so forth. Some of you will know my disciplinary formation is in history of science and technology, and historians of technology get way, way tense about technological determinist arguments. We completely get our knickers in twists when people start arguing that technologies sort of, you know, make societies, because it's our job to remind you of the dialectical underbelly of that story, wherein societies make their technologies, and the technologies they make are presumably reflective of the societies they are.
Yeah, it's really the other way around.
We have to sit through so many seminars together, Kenny, to get to the bottom of this. So I guess rather than sort of, I mean, again, this one, you know, does technology drive history? There are no fewer than three edited volumes, all with different versions of that title available. We won't do the really boring version of this, but I do think we ought to zero in on the question of the techne and the technology, the practices, the devices. I wish I had it here to blow up. I don't, but it's through Anne's work that I was introduced to the scrinium literatum, and maybe you'd pick up while I kind of hold it up and try to show people. This is, I don't know if you can't really see it, but imagine a little box divided into 10,000 additional little drawers and pegs and hooks. And this was sort of like, you know, FileMaker Pro circa 1590. And maybe you tell us a little bit about how these devices worked. And let's go down into the technologies of this in the Renaissance and then think back toward the technologies of our moment.
So this closet was described in print immediately contemporaneously with the system that Locke prints that's in the little book here.
Which is 1689. For sale in the back of the room, $12.
It was very high-end. We only know for sure that two of them were made, one by the author of this published book and one which was owned by Leibniz, although it doesn't survive. He was librarian in Hanover, and apparently someone, a member of the court there, had it made and had given it to him for his duties. Leibniz was, of course, a notoriously messy note-taker who described preferring to do the work over again than to try and find the note he'd taken on it in the mess of his study. So basically, it's a closet you open up, and then the beauty of it is you see in one glance ahead of you these slats, at least A through, there are probably hundreds of them, 300, let's say, and each one of them has a number of headings, the loci, inscribed on white lead, and behind each heading there's a hook. And on the hook are your notes on slips that are loose, Loose slip is a very dangerous thing. And the note takers always say, naughty, naughty to have loose notes. They can blow away. They will get out of order. You will lose them. This is bad. Glue your slips onto sheets of paper. But here is one of the first times then that the recommendation is to keep your notes loose because they are interchangeable, because you can share them with other people. You can have other people contribute to the closet, but they're under control by the hook, the metal hook. And in fact, this poking paper onto hooks, what much like, you know, I think the dry cleaners are probably the only folks who still do that, right? This was filing in early modern commercial archiving. So the file is a piece of wire onto which you poke your stuff, your letters or your documents that you want to save again. So this is a technology whereby the note, the slip, the loose slip can be disciplined. And 100 years later then, the loose slip becomes even more loose. Linnaeus makes slips. They're not standardized yet. These are all actual pieces of paper that people have cut to match the size of the note that they have. Very convenient. No wasted paper there. Blaise Pascal is another man who used thread to create, to link sheets, slips in a bundle. Of course, we don't have the bundles. We have the remnants of the bundles. We can see the holes on the pieces of paper that were then glued into manuscripts because that was considered the safer way of saving the stuff. So cutting and pasting is very much a literal process in this period, and the 15th century is the first time, I would argue, paper makes it possible. But also, I don't want to be a technological determinist. I am from the same field as Graham, and I'm very nervous about this. In other words, the idea is Europeans could have behaved differently toward printing, toward the New World, toward ancient texts. And indeed, you know, if you look, China had printing much earlier in the 8th century. They had no explosion of books with printing. They used printing to print Buddhist prayers for 400 years. And then in the 12th century, the elite sort of got into it, and the government started printing things, and the literati started printing things. And 400 years after that, in the 16th century, you start getting much more popular genres, novels, how-to books, and stuff like that. So it's a long process, 800 years, really, for printing to penetrate all the areas that that we associate with printing in early modern Europe. So why did printing, in other words, there's no essence of mechanical reproduction that's going to have a necessary difference. It's going to be in combination with a cultural system. And my argument is that there is this desire to stockpile, to save. And for me, what causes that desire to stockpile and save, not just texts, but also stuff, specimens from the New World, and paintings, and medals, and statues, and all those live books, is, I would say, the trauma of loss. That's the one, the Renaissance is deeply aware that there was this great stuff in antiquity, and we lost most of it. And that's just horrible. Never again. Now, we're going to save it. We're going to stockpile it. We're going to have libraries. We're going to print it. We're going to have multiple copies. We'll have redundancy. And nothing thought will ever be lost. I've got one note taker who says that. He didn't want anything thought by anyone to ever be lost, lest it someday be useful to someone. That's the spirit of it. Of course, it gets you into trouble. It gets you with a fair amount of overload, doesn't it?
Actually, I think the problem is usefulness. You know, and I think that's probably where it all boils down to, is that there was a point to all of it, to all of this stuff that had to do with utility, and what I'm talking about is actually the same type of activity that leads to pointlessness for its own point, as its own point. There's so much to talk about because I want to talk about Swift's writing machine in Gulliver's Travels, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. Swift says he imagines this machine whereby, and he quotes, the most ignorant person at a reasonable charge and with a little bodily labor might write books in philosophy, poetry, politics, laws, mathematics, and theology without the least assistance from genius or study, right? Mm-hmm. So he devises this machine, right, which is a grid-based machine, with every word in the English language inscribed upon it, right? And by cranking a few handles, the grid would slide a little bit, and random groups of half-sensible phrases would fall into place. Crank it again, the device would spit out another set of non sequiturs, probably looking a lot like modernist poetry. And then these resulting broken sentences were jotted down by scribes into folios, or that were proposed to be, of course, and like giant pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, were intended to be fit together in an effort to rebuild the English language entirely from scratch, albeit written by machine, right? And of course, the Swiftian punchline is that the English language was fine as it was, and the novelty of reconstructing it by a machine wasn't going to make it any better. Okay, and it's a pointed satire, I think, in terms of my blinding belief in the transformative potential of technology. I think the Swiftian lesson is very good, and yet it's also possible to view Swift's proposition as an act or a provocation or a proposition, a Duchampian proposition of uncreative writing, particularly when placed in the context of, say, Pierre Menard's rewriting of Don Quixote, or this guy that retyped, Simon Morris, that retyped On the Road into back into a blog.
Am I allowed to interrupt you there? Just because this seems to go right to the heart of something so interesting, because I don't know the guy who retyped the Kerouac into the blog.
You wouldn't. He's obscure.
He's obscure, but okay, but I get the idea. But let's just go in here for one more minute, because the Borges readers know that the whole shtick of the Borges is that Menard's rewriting of the Quixote takes him most of his life, and as I recall, he gets through two sentences. And what he's, of course, trying to do is steep himself so entirely in Cervantes's life world that he can regenerate the text out of a kind of psycho-spiritual historical commensuration with the author of the original. So this is an exercise of kind of histrionic humanism at its most deranged.
Right.
And sure, it reaches an inversion point, but it couldn't
exactly.
be more different, it seems to me, as a gesture than the
retelling
of Kerouac. Exactly. Do you want to talk?
No. I mean, Menard is a genius. You know, he's got a terrible sense of timing, but he's an actual genius because he writes the same book. He just doesn't know that it had been written before. So this is a great work of creativity, but completely lost. Whereas, you know, I mean, Morris's retyping of On the Road this retyping of On the Road arises out of a comment that I made. This is obscure, and starts at Princeton. And I'm doing a visiting thing at Princeton, and the students are complaining to me about a workshop with one of the America's most famous fiction writers, and they're complaining about her lack of creativity in these assignments. And one of the assignments was to write a piece in the style of On the Road. Okay, and bring it in next week. Okay, and so you know they all try to
pastiche
getting into Kerouac's head in order to write this book, but in fact it's impossible. It's impossible to get into Kerouac's head. I mean, you know, you have to be driving a 55 Buick down a ribbon of desert highway, with gulping down handfuls of Benzedrine and in one hand and Jack Daniels in the other, and even then it wouldn't work because you'd be restaging an act, and it's a really a disastrous thing. So my idea of this was, and then this is really where this is gets a little bit interesting. I said to them, well, wouldn't it be better for you to just have taken On the Road and retype some of it? I mean, wouldn't you have learned more about Kerouac's style by simply copying Kerouac? And then my mind flashed to when you go to the Met and the painters are sitting there in front of the Van Goghs, and they're how do painters learn? They copy. When we copy, it's called plagiarism. It's called unoriginality. You see, so this is to me really, really quite interesting. When earlier, you're saying this as a way of learning, a way of knowing, and a way of integrating it to yourself. A way of actually becomes personal, because I in my classes I make the kids. One of the first assignments I do with them in my uncreative writing class is I say, retype five pages and bring it in next week. You know, retype five pages and bring it in. I say nothing more, and they all scratch their head. You know, we're paying $50,000 for this. Wait till my parents find out. And so they leave, and they're very upset. But what happens is they all bring in something completely unique and something that is completely expressive of who they are. What did you choose to type, first of all? Why did you choose to type it? And you begin to not really look at what they've retyped because it's a retyping, but in fact, you start to ask the questions around it. And then you start to ask more formal questions that really have everything to do with writing, but we never think about with writing. Did you, if the book was hard justified, did you hard justify your text? Where the page broke, did you go to the other page? Did you try to replicate the page size? What about the font? What about the paper stock? What does that paper stock have to say about you? What about, you know, all of these decisions that are all about writing that we never think about that come to the fore? And suddenly, by the time it's out, they realize that these retyping of five pages is some of the most personal writing that they've ever done. But of course, you know, they would have been kicked out of any other class for doing it. So I said, this is really, to me, this is really the boomerang effect of the stuff that you're talking about now. Really fascinating.
I'm wondering if I just jump in there about, so the technology that the humanists are using is the hand. It is a handwriting, it's the pen, and then it's orality. I mean, there's lots of learning by heart, too. So that, you know, everybody learns, and that's, you know, beginning of the Bible or Virgil or whatever, and these are how you can rearticulate more readily. And here we're talking about typing. Even in my own time, I mean, I remember writing things out by hand. That's how I started. And I'm wondering what difference it makes, if any. Obviously, the mind, so one of the reasons that the pedagogues of the early modern period like writing out is it slows down the mind. It forces you to focus. You can't just sort of, you know, rush through. And that works for typing, too, presumably, although if we start using voice recognition or automated typing in some way, cutting and pasting.
It slows you down because you're typing something that you shouldn't be interested in. So then it slows you down. I had students, they begin to feel their body when they type. You know, but typing is an act of physicality. You know, writing is a physical act. But of course, nobody ever, you know, this is all about, you know, the transparent process of writing that we're all brought up to only focus on those sort of the best bits, the meaningful thoughts. When you actually put somebody in front of a typewriter and they're retyping something that's not particularly interesting, there is all sorts of slowing down and noticing. Mm-hmm. Noticing, it's Cagean. You know, one begins to notice, you know, the sounds in the room. You know?
So, I mean, a way to kind of hold this question before us and link it back to this question of selfhood is to emphasize memory for a moment and the ways in which these different writing practices represent kind of habits and habitus of the self. Anne has referred to the ways in which these commonplacing practices and collatory practices were about externalizing one's memory. A scrinium like this is, you know, emphatically a kind of cognitive prosthetic, in much the same way that, you know, these now are cognitive prostheses. So there's another kind of technological parallel between the two. But I'm struck, you know, maybe even by pulling you back further and bringing us back to a scribal tradition, because those guys were the kind of uncreative writers, right? I mean, there was a major period in Western European history where the business of being a person of letters meant basically spending most of your day copying texts. It's before your period.
I just have to interrupt because the only person in my class that really had a lousy experience with my uncreative writing of five pages was a girl who had a job as a waitress, and she was trying to memorize her menu so she could be better at her job. She hated the utility spoiled it. Mm-hmm. You see, we go back, really, I think, it, you know, again with memory, when this is applied practically, it's a disaster. It's enslavement. And when it's applied, quote, uncreatively or creatively, it's liberating. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but it's so...
This is great. And again, it speaks back to this question of the self. I mean, maybe one of the things we're saying is kind of practices of memory are importantly over because these prostheses are powerful in ways that make the business of maintenance of memory less significant. I feel people, you know, wanting to start to get in with some questions. So we're going to do one more little phase here where I'm going to push one more time on Kenny just to see if I've got the project. And then so start thinking about your questions. We've got a mic, I think. Have we? A wireless? Yeah. So Kenny, just to finish out my little like half analogy with the scribal age, you know, this idea that copying as an uncreative act can be liberating and that the utility of copying is an enslavement, I'm down with, I can feel it. This notion that there's enough written, we don't need more. So let's kind of, in some sense, work with what we've got from this point out. I also like there's a notion of kind of custodianship or something over what already is. And that you might go like this and bring it out and put it somewhere else feels a little bit like a gesture of curatorship or something like that.
Getting the best bits.
Well, this is where I'm kind of, again, still fussing, because if it's perfectly arbitrary, then the purposiveness without purpose that Kant sort of is like the definition of art might go all the way simply to the clinical. You know, it might just be schizo.
And what's wrong with that?
It might not be bad. I just want to see where you put your pin on
well,
that.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm happy to push the pin as far as it can go. I'm actually interested in seeing if that's actually possible. But the point is, it's actually it's not arbitrary. It's not arbitrary. These gestures are not arbitrary. If they were arbitrary, it'd be a disaster. And you actually see this now because this sort of uncreative writing has become a thing, and you see so many awful choices. Okay, you see people that aren't careful about what they're picking and aren't choosing something that's actually resonant and meaningful. I mean, I say, you know, the whole web. You can just cut and paste the entire internet. Yeah, how interesting is that, really? And this is what the younger generation says, but you're so conservative, you know, you're still holding on to these notions of genius, Goldsmith, you know, you're actually preaching it. And in a way, they're right, because the most radical gestures, the most radical gesture in writing that I can think of today that actually pushes these buttons was done by a couple of my students, and it was a big provocation. What they did was they made the largest anthology of poetry ever written, containing 4,000 poets, okay? And they made a PDF of it, and they sent it out on a Friday night. Saturday morning, every poet, of course, has a Google alert. So they realize that their name is appearing in this big anthology, and they never heard of this anthology before. So they all download it, and they open up their page, and they find their name. And what's there is not a poem written by them, but a poem that was generated by a machine and had their name ascribed to it. Okay? And this really caused a big mess up in the community, because it really does mess up all sorts of notions of genius and propriety. And it split the community. Half the people said, well, this is immoral. What you're doing is you're immoral. And then the other 4,000 poets that weren't included said, hey, how come I wasn't? So it really didn't matter what was written. You know, it becomes more holy, and it becomes much more meta. It's about the method of distribution and the inclusion and the game, the sort of meta game, rather than what's written. Of course, nobody's ever going to pay attention to what's written. And I think it really kind of pulls the curtain back on what many people are thinking about today. You know, I mean, Warhol, when he got a bad review, they say, Andy, how do you feel when you get a bad review? And Warhol said, I don't read my reviews. I just add up the column inches. You see, and I think this is really actually very prescient. And this is really where it's landed today.
The floor is open. Do we have a...
I'm going to leave now.
Don't be afraid, Kenny. Why don't we go... You were quite concerned. Go. Can you come up here? Thank you so much. And then to the back.
Hi. Very interesting stuff going on. And I think a lot of the stuff that you're talking about, rather than being production of self or shattering of the self, goes back to maybe late 19th, early 20th century stuff, talking about role management. And it comes through especially with the lawyer, who's all of a sudden a poet, and also is reflected in the student who, once she brings in her actual, you know, a role that she would rather ignore in life, she's having problems with that. And so I think, rather than talking about the self, a better way to unpack it would be to talk about what these people are doing and how the different texts might be extensions of the self. Rather than talking about technological determinism, we can talk about them as technologies of the self, and then.
Can I just make sure I understand? Because when you initially said role management, I thought, huh, yes, how interesting. Then as you continued to talk, I found myself wondering again, so how is role management different from a kind of production of the self? Do you want to distinguish those and say that by thinking about production of the self, we're asking the wrong question? Or do you want to say that the way we now think about self is more centrally concerned with the business of role management maybe than in the Renaissance or something?
The latter,
okay. Thoughts on that, role management?
Role management, I mean, avatars. I mean, what isn't role management today? You know, really? I mean, that's what we spend our life doing, is managing versions of ourselves. You know, and I think if writing doesn't in some way really begin to reflect those machinations that, you know, may not, I say it's not contemporary.
Do you want in on this notion of sort of role management as a characteristic of our moment?
I think people were managing roles back in the Renaissance too. Erasmus, for example, a whole book's written about how he, you know, markets himself for different audiences and so on, as part of selfhood in a way. And I'm sort of not so comfortable thinking that we've completely delegated memory to, you know, technology off-site. I mean, we still have personal experience, or obviously if we don't, then it's a problem.
It's true. It's
what's wrong with that?
It's true, although, I mean, you know, this is a very big issue.
Right.
This is a very big issue, and I mean, it's funny, because what am I doing right now? I'm typing in Irving Goffman into my iPhone so I can remind myself of the title of the great Irving Goffman book on presentation of the self in daily everyday life as a kind of significant sociological text on exactly this, you know, problem. Less. I'll go to Simmel next.
See, but I use still, it to you know, absolutely right. You absolutely. I mean, this is there. It is, and really, the fact that you didn't know the title of Goffman's book, nobody, you know, and the fact that you can get it here. Does anybody have a problem with that?
No, but I do think it has, and I think we'd all be agreed that it probably has enormous implications for how we think both about kind of creative production or uncreative production, if you prefer.
Absolutely.
And also it has enormous implications for kind of scholars who have traditionally thought of kind of having as much of that crap in your head as was humanly possible.
But you had to have something there to know what to look up.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you didn't know the title, but you did... So you had a placeholder.
He heard role management and remembered Goffman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go right.
So it's keywording. It's keywording.
Right.
No, it's
but
fine.
There is
it's managing information. What? I mean, how could he not do that?
Go ahead. Yeah.
So I was just thinking back to the Swift satire that you brought up, and it seems to me that the sort of interesting and impression thing about that, or at least one of them, has to do with the fact that it's kind of satirizing the idea that you really can make a machine that produces language like a human, that the way we sort of creatively produce works is formalizable, maybe in the way that, you know, Gödel or Turing would have talked about later. And so, I mean, it strikes me that there's some level of, if you just have a sort of creative artist who's thinking of what to write, it's not just like they have text inside the mind and text outside the mind, just like syntax all the way through. There's some kind of level of like, perhaps, I mean, this is probably up for debate, but indeterminacy in the creative writer themselves. So I wonder if you can really say that it's just info management all the way through, info management in the mind, info management outside, that it's just all kind of textual operations. It seems to me that that's one of the things that maybe Swift was kind of making fun of.
Absolutely.
You could say, tough, we've discovered that it really is, but.
I think that really gets back to Wittgenstein, you know. Mm-hmm. Those questions of isn't all language a game? You know, it's right, you know, I mean, it's really very basic stuff. But I want to say that as I don't know if anybody's ever heard of this guy named Bill Chamberlain, who in 1984 actually published a book called "The Policeman's Beard Is Half Constructed," that was written by a computer called Rachter, right? And you know, it really is a contemporary enactment and very unironic of Swift's machine, and you know, it really is a disaster. The book is a disaster. Syntactically correct. I would come up with one of the sentences that Rachter came up with. Many enraged psychiatrists are inciting a weary butcher. The butcher is weary and tired because he has cut meat and steak and lamb for hours and weeks. You know, and this is actually written by in BASIC. You know, so in fact, you know, you're right. It's not good. It's a bit of a disastrous book, and it's seeing what the computer is capable of, but without the proper input, as you're talking about, the creative input. And I do want to say that the inverse of, you know, I keep using the word uncreative, but in fact, it's a reinvestigation of creativity that actually just asks different questions so that we can get the juices flowing again. Is so much in play. I mean, I really don't want to deny that. I actually want to support that, your idea.
Since the young man kind of intones something vaguely crypto-humanist, can I just put you on the spot a little bit more and just be like...
I'd handle it, yeah.
Yeah, is the last thing you said there, I'm feeling like it's you and Charlie Williams going like, kumbaya in the end? Because like, if you're just trying to restart us, because ultimately the project is to kind of keep pursuing the human and all these aphasic dislocations and transparencies of the self to what is before us are simply mechanisms for a kind of rebirth. That's easy, but I've sensed that you want something harder, weirder, and fundamentally more rebarbative to our sense of self-pursuit.
No, actually, I'm actually split. I mean, I actually think the guys that did issue one feel that way. I'm actually, you know, I'm a bridge generation. You know, I'm very much between the two. I kind of feel that, like, really the conversation is heading actually away from us completely. And I'm not so sure I'm so thrilled about this. I mean, today most data being generated is dark data, which is data being written by machines for other machines to read, okay? And I actually have for example, if the dishwasher or the dryer is off kilter, it now sends some language in alphanumeric code, the same language that was from which, you know, Shakespeare's sonnets were wrought in alpha, even though in a different configuration, to a server which responds back and actually makes an adjustment. This is called dark data. Video that's being digitally captured all the time is dark data, which far outweighs any sort of human data that's going. But I actually want to cite Christian Book, who really, and I'm not so thrilled about this. So I'm not all you think I am. Book though might be. And Christian says, we are probably the first generation of poets who can reasonably expect to write literature for a machinic audience of artificially intellectual peers. If it is not already evident by our presence at conferences on digital poetics that the poets of tomorrow are likely to resemble programmers, exalted not because they can write great poems, but because they can build a small drone out of words to write great poems for us. If poetry already lacks, I love this idea, if poetry already lacks any meaningful readership among our own anthropoid population, what have we to lose by writing poetry for a robotic culture that must inevitably succeed our own? If we want to commit an act of poetic innovation in an era of formal exhaustion, we may have to consider this heretofore unimagined but nevertheless prohibited option, writing poetry for inhuman readers who do not yet exist because such aliens, clones, or robots have not yet evolved to read it. You know, that's really pushing the, you know, where you're asking.
Go ahead. The mic is coming. Here you go.
Fetishistic.
Go ahead.
Is he what?
Isn't Christian just a touch fetishistic in his approach?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, you think I'm bad.
I mean I like really, it. I like really stuff. Bad. Don't get me wrong.
You know, I do feel a little bit mixed. You know, I'm with it, but not, you know.
Okay, great. How about Albert Mobili?
As part of this project of seeing your work as more retrograde than perhaps many people might, I think that this idea that somehow the self or that creativity is displaced by moving from expressive content, whether it's pre-modernist or in the modernist era, to these sort of textual operations is an interesting one, because I think from, let's say, the point of view of a computational linguist who's putting together, let's say, 50 newspapers 365 days a year, developing a linguistic corpus, he might see the fact that you took a single day of a single newspaper and chose to retype that as just as much a pursuit of le mot juste any more traditional operation. So I wonder about that, Kenny. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's really funny. When I was actually writing this book, which took me a year to do, I'm figuring that I'm doing the same work that somebody's getting paid, you know, 20 blocks away, you know, for the New York Times. You know, I mean, even though, you know, I'm actually performing the same labor set without compensation, you know, as meager as the person typing out the data entry. So I hear what you're saying. You know, it's a book that's being written 900 times a day around the world, every newspaper. If every newspaper was turned into a book, I mean, the point was to actually show the textual abundance in the analog newspaper as a demonstration, as much as anything. One newspaper is nine. No, it's political. It's social. It's literary.
And the selectivity.
Absolutely. That's why it's a great book. Seriously, because it's a great book. For the reason Rachter isn't, because it's got all of that in it. The daily newspaper, it's got triumph, it's got defeat, it's got love, it's got murder, it's got envy, it's got, you know,
stock tables.
It's got stock tables. You know, it's got dramatic rises and awful fall. You know, I mean, it really is a great book.
So historians have been shaken by a piece that ran in Science just about a month ago, which was by Pinker and a bunch of his buddies at Harvard. Some of you will be familiar with it. Basically taking the Google Books database, which they were given access to because they broke it up into very small bits, and so they were given even access to the stuff that you can't get because copyright restrictions won't let you have it, and they used it in effect to kind of data mine philological change over the last 300 years and to make a set of large scale historical arguments about the rise of democracy, the, you know, women's rights, using simply keyword appearances over a database that represented about an eighth of the total volume of printed matter that had ever been created on Earth. And in that context, I think, you know, Albert's point that there's something positively romantic about copying the entirety of one day's New York Times, and that it is a kind of act of high humanistic attention to the individual, kind of, it's kind of a striking.
But you know, it gets back to Duchamp. I mean, Duchamp became Duchamp because of what he chose. Any modernist trying to kill art did it with the most exquisite taste, and we admire the taste. You know, the urinal
these
was
the best bits that you were disparaging.
Somebody's exploding next to you.
Wait, I have to introduce Catelyn Tully.
No, please not before I speak, because then it's totally embarrassing.
All right, after you read. Fine, okay. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to ask, because there's been a lot of talk of roles and context and self-awareness, and now with the Science article, terms and definitions, and we haven't really spoken about audience very much. And I'm curious, because there's this history with commonplaces with Quintilian and Cicero, you know, as a like form of oratory and rhetoric. And I was wondering, Anne, if you would be willing to talk a little bit about the chronology of some of this, where best bits transition between best bits as expert versus best bits as representative. So sort of what's the common definition versus what's maybe the aspirational definition? It seems to me like now we're starting to transition to a place maybe with the Wikipedia and everything where we want to assume there is no difference between the two. And I'm wondering like how you see that going back and forth. And
interesting, thanks. Yeah. I think, so the pedagogues of the humanist era want you to collect things you want to imitate, but you don't want to be trite. Right, so something that everybody has in their notebook, you don't want in your notebook. So there is a sense in which you want to exercise judgment. I mean, that's And this is going to be something individual that will, and that the teacher can only model for you. Everyone has to find their judgment. And it's a form of voice, and that's what's most valued. So the best bits, then of course, reference books are about taking one person's best bits and making them available to everybody. So of course that then becomes trite, right? So I think Swift is really mocking he feels that these reference books have made possible automatic writing practically, right? Because you can just grab bits from here and there and slap them together and make yourself something that looks learned, that looks like it's informed by, you know, painstaking individual appreciation, et cetera. And it's not. It's just based on a shortcut. So, but it doesn't mean that the quest for the sort of unique or the manifestation of judgment isn't still pursued. But the reference book is put down as, obviously, the reference book authors, compilers, they boast about how useful this will be. But there's a whole gang of late humanists or people like Swift who feel that this is, you know, making every Tom, Dick, and Harry can pretend to be great, and really all this is actually, we need a whole new level of selection of what genuine creativity is, because, you know, just dropping allusions to classical antiquity is too easy now.
Basically. But you know what's remarkable about that is that you know, assembling the best of is what we do all the time. You know, I mean, the best bits, but we manage information, you know, say iTunes playlists, you know, what's on my playlist, and then, of course, distributing it and sharing it. And I want to take it even a little bit further to say that you know, Albert, I mean, I think best bits, you know, best bits, even if this is the best bit to move in its entirety, it's still the best bit, which makes it the best move to make, you know, as opposed to, you know, I'm not saying, you know, everything goes. It's still actually very much tied into selecting the best bits. And I want to say that the people that have the most power on the web are not people that are actually making things, but they're people that are pointing to things. So you have a blog like Boing Boing that is the most powerful blog on the web. They have never done a fucking thing. All they've done is point to they've curated it for you. Or example, you think about these re-gestures, the retweeting is a form of power. I'll tweet something. And I'll tweet something that's very long and very dense, an avant-garde film, on and on and on, very long or a very long thing. And suddenly I look and it's been retweeted 20 times. Now there's no way in that 30 seconds that anybody could have engaged with this information. But in fact, it's about the moving, again, the moving of that information and the sharing and the distribution, the illusion of knowing, even you know, I mean, even name dropping isn't that cool to name drop Janae in your Twitter feed, you know, which is actually going to spark off another micro community and another micro wave of reblogging. Nobody looks at content. Again, it's about, I mean, it's too silly. No, that's dumb. But I want to say that. But you know, I'm being hyperbolic here. In fact, it's about the moving of information now rather than the engagement with it. And I think this is really actually very similar to what you're almost exactly what you're saying.
Although this feels more kinetic. It almost feels like, you know, text as dance performance. Catelyn wanted a follow-up, and she gets it because what you don't know is that Catelyn is the student who first drew my attention to the existence of the original of this book in Firestone Library, which Princeton University Library. Catelyn was working on a paper on originalism and constitutionalism and textual practices in the late 18th century and stumbled on this book, which we've reprinted. She is in the acknowledgments. Catelyn, a follow-up.
Wow. Better be good. I wanted to ask when Ken was just pointing to commonplaces as power. And it seems to me where I was trying to go with my question about audience was this idea of sort of a commonplace where you send your rhetoric and it means one thing in that arena versus the commonplace where you put the knowledge that you accrue that you want to think about. And I was wondering, I mean, you see that in the stuff that I was working on in the 18th century, you do see like Jefferson saying, you know, this is my public argument and this is my private thinking about that argument in his commonplace book. But I was curious if, you know, like Erasmus, other men who had these sort of dual lives. Do you see that to some extent in the?
Certainly, there's a difference between the private and the public, and of course, letters. There are whole shades of what's private and public because people do share their notes sometimes, and they also share letters, but they don't want them shared too far. So, Yes, I think I wouldn't see notes. The notes I work with tend not to be, though, an insight into what's hidden from the public. They are tend to be much more impersonal, lacking judgment, actually, except insofar as they select, and they assign a heading. So obviously that's a choice they're making. But you don't get as much of the reflection on as you might expect. So Pascal, say, was a later, you know, late 17th century. Of course, those are thoughts. And some of them are reading notes, but others of them are his own ideas, basically thoughts toward a book. And then by the 18th century, I think it's well agreed on that note-taking sort of degenerates. The commonplace book becomes a diary for some people. It can be collections of impersonal notes, but it's all over the place. I mean, there are many kinds. Whereas the typical humanist commonplace book is a rather impersonal thing.
If we could go back on the aisle to the ladies there. And, you know, it remains important in poetry, too, just while we're waiting. Wallace Stevens's commonplace book.
W. H. Auden.
Auden also.
Go ahead. Hi. I'm just wondering if you could both maybe speak a little bit about the notion of limits and control and mastery in both of these spheres. I mean, I'm making a connection between the title of Anne's book, you know, Too Much to Know, and then, okay, we have enough language. So where those limits are drawn and how that, I guess, affects what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Limits.
Yeah, I think what does strike me as very different in the mentality around the theme of usefulness is that these guys have tremendous confidence that, on the one hand, we're almost there. I mean, that's sort of Francis Bacon's view. We're going to collect a lot of stuff, and we're going to do it for a couple generations, and then we're going to have all there is to know, and we're going to have moral and social reform that's going to come sort of unproblematically from the accumulation of facts. So that's Bacon's vision. I think Zwinger actually has been cited as a potential source for Bacon. Zwinger thinks he's doing really important stuff, that it can be done to create a theater of all human behavior. And I think there's a sense that it is useful. It isn't pointless. It's a work in progress still, but there also is this great faith that it's, you know, the end is right around the corner. And it will bring good stuff. It will bring, because the point of accumulating examples is moral edification. We will all be better people for seeing laid out before us all the bad and all the good. And also, it's a kick to read because you get all kinds of, you know, salacious details. So there's pleasure in it as well. But the rhetoric surrounding the justification is utility fulfilled soon.
This is all predicated on an idea, the idea going back to hubris that you talked about earlier, that there was a time when one presumed that they could possess all the knowledge that there was to know in the world. Of course, it was an illusion then. And I think what the digital age has made us aware of is actually how little we really know. And so, you know, starting from that, then it's a matter of culling and arranging that, you know, I want to talk about a textual ecology. I want to talk about ecologies of information management. You know, you begin to understand language. Once it's freed from the page, it becomes a fluid. It becomes a fluid entity. It becomes a material that can be as easily parsed into a data. The same text can be parsed into a database, can be turned into a Photoshop document, can be put in, inserted into, and turned into music. I mean, you see, the problem is that, you know, and I don't want to get into cliches of how much information there is, but what I do want to make very clear is that today, all of our media, this is unprecedented, this never happened before, all of our media, all of our music, all of our images, all of our songs, everything is comprised of language, okay? And it is, again, I want to say it's the same alphabet. I think that's, is that mine? I want to say it's the same same set, almost, of alphanumeric language, again, from which Shakespeare wrote his sonnets, okay? So I want to say that you would have a photograph, and never could you pull back a photograph and find any language. But if you take, and we all have received a JPEG in the email that comes in wrong, and it's a slew of language, not in any order that we can possibly understand. But in fact, you can actually open up any film, any piece of music, any piece of graphic imagery, and you will find that it is comprised completely of alphanumeric language. This is absolutely unprecedented. And chuck more language into that file, save it, and then reopen it as a JPEG, and you'll actually see a reconfiguration, language acting upon language. The materiality of the sheer potential of materiality of language is really something I really, really want to emphasize here, is that this is the first time, you know, and I think concrete poetry points to that. You know, there are these moves that actually point toward the materiality of language, even language poetry, the materiality of language. But never could it be this effective. And so, you know, that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about the language under the skin of all media today. And this is why I'm not even going to go there.
Just a quick one here. I think we have time for two more questions. It's warm in here. I know people will get tired. I just wondered, do you see in the wake of the printing press any shivers of this kind of mad, the mass of text, like a flow, like a mass into which we could carve instead of concerning ourselves with meaning? Any echoes of that relationship to what language had become in the wake of the print revolution? Or does that feel alien and of our time, you know, familiar to us now but remote from the early modern period?
I think there is a lot of, there's a tremendous outpouring of complaint of this overabundance of books. Of course, all of these things are in books. any solution to the problem is going to use the medium, of course, or that's the kind we get that's come down to us mainly. There is an idea, they're experimenting with universal languages. They're trying to make new symbolic languages. If we could get a perfect language, so idea of looking back at Hebrew, obviously, would be one kind of perfect language. But then let's scrap and start from scratch. That's Wilkins' project. So there's a lot of reflection on language. Obviously, it's still very optimistic. The sort of the circle of the known players is smaller, and the idea is we're going to get it right, or that there's potential, rather than this idea that it's an absurd quest. That's not there yet.
Go back to the floor, maybe here on the aisle. We're saying just quickly that the Wilkins to whom Anne alludes, it has been argued, is the butt of the satire in the Swift with the machine for generating language. So most of the Swift satirizes specific projects that came through the Royal Society over the previous 80 years, and you can tag up almost every stupid thing that's made fun of in Gulliver's Travels with one of the specific projects, and Wilkins's universal language may well be one.
There's a wiki for that.
There's a wiki for that. This man.
All right, so this question kind of comes from that, the topics of practices of selfhood versus literary practices of expression. And I was thinking about the concepts of, you know, the questioning about original genius and, you know, in that grander sense. But when you take it back down to a more personal level, I'm wondering how that affects individual expression between more intimate relations. So in both the pre-modern and post-modern times, you both have pointed out the notion of an author is more vague, but so too is the notion of publication, i.e. making something public. So I guess the question is, how does this sense of relinquishing of a text's ownership affect the intentionality and sort of salutation of, say, for instance, one of the most basic forms of literary selfhood or expression, which would then be a letter, a personal letter?
Kenny.
Once a text is digitized, once that letter is digitized, there is no ownership of it. I mean, there's ownership in a local ecology, which would be the stuck on the hard drive. I can absolutely control it. If it's here and it's not connected, I can control it. But the minute I email it to anybody, it becomes fodder for remix, I want to say. You know, it becomes destabilized immediately. As a matter of fact, if you just forwarding an email, one thing we tend to not to ignore completely when we forward an email are the headers. So there's this like vast clinging of language that occurs, a, 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 palimpsest, really, of a whole other layer of language that is the language of the headers. You don't think about it as being meaningful, but if you begin to think about it in its material sense, it is more writing. And actually, there's modernist precedence to actually take all of, you say, oh, no, no, but that's just code. That's not meaning. But if there actually are precedents in modernism that actually have read, that give you precedence to actually read that as literature, if you choose to, you know, if you have the, put those glasses on. I'm not saying, you know, we don't all the time. But if we wanted to do a close reading of email headers, we will find, you know, we will find an enormous amount of traditional literary value in those headers, okay? And so I just want to say that, you know, again, I want to talk about these ideas of ecosystems and instability. And you know, I always say that, you know, really, if you want, you know, if you want to be, you know, the best way, if you don't want something to be public, is really to handwrite it. Don't digitize it. Don't put it on the web. Terrorists, for example, they do beautiful things with handwritten notes these days, you know. And so I want to talk about instability, really, instability and no possession, because it gets passed around very quickly.
Print revolution and interpersonal epistolary communication.
So the status of letters is very mixed and unclear. Copyright of 1710 actually establishes the author of the letter as the person whose permission you need before you print a letter. But until then, you have a letter in your hand, you can do what you want with it. And so printing other people's letters without their consent was certainly happened. In fact, letters can also be doctored when that happens, and there are all kinds of cases of letters being attributed to people who may or may not have written them and complaints about it. And, of course, the recourse is another act of print in which you complain about X and so misrepresenting and so on. Many authors say in their prefaces that they rush to publication in order to nip in the bud some, you know, illegitimate project of publishing their stuff without their permission, whether it was letters or whether it was lectures, for example, a course that they gave and that students took notes on. So there's a lot of anxiety about, and of course Adrian Johns is very eloquent on this concern around piracy and misuse and so on. I just want to mention some very cool stuff about headers of manuscript letters, that there's a lot of symbolism in the white space, the form of address, and in fact, looking through archives, you can watch people doctoring and complaining about forms of address and changing them and so forth. This is work being done by Gero Sternberg under Louis XIV. So the protocol of letter writing is very, subject to an act of concern. Now, I would say another way to bury something is not just manuscript, but frankly, to keep it on your hard drive, it'll be inaccessible. You know, if you don't upgrade it to new software and new hardware, it'll be dead. Right, of the web, I agree, we'll get carried forward. But we're all generating our own note stocks. Unless you upgrade them, will be inaccessible, certainly in 500 years, but I think probably in 10. And of course, I've just had a great time looking at the notes of, you know, Poliziano or whoever that have been moldering in a library, but ink on paper has proven to be.
It's a good place probably to end, not least because the introduction to a little commonplace book, on the title page, it says it's by John Locke. It's actually pirated from a letter that John Locke wrote in French to a correspondent, and which was then translated into English and circulated dozens of times over in countless versions, Locke receiving no royalties on any of them, no royalties, needless to say, on your $12 contributions to Cabinet. Books in the back, drinks. Join me in thanking our wonderful panelists.
Thank you.